Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is a woman who has been in the news of late, and that is Miss Lucy White, who is a political commentator, who we're going to talk about a number of things, but who most recently, on the 26th of November, in response to the budget, put out the following tweet. Today, the Deputy Speaker presiding over the budget statement in the UK House of Commons is Nus Ghani. Nus Ghani was born in Kashmir, Pakistan. There should not be a single person born in Pakistan in the UK House of Commons. At the time of me talking to you, this has been shared about 2,200 times. It's received about 2,500 comments and, interestingly, about 15,000 likes. And a lot of those shares have been to condemn it by various Conservative MPs, by Kay Burley of Sky TV and of various others. So this is the woman herself. So, Lucy, hello.
Hello, it's great to be here today. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So tell me then, it's a bit of a ballsy thing to do, isn't it, for a relatively young woman to put out a tweet basically saying that the Speaker is Pakistani and shouldn't be in the House of Commons. What was it that pushed you to just go for it?
Well, for me, this is just a normal tweet. I do this very often. And so I was very surprised that it had 6 million views and went viral. You know, I stand by the fact that there should not be any foreigners in the UK House of Commons. And the reason, the thing that drew my attention in particular to Nus Ghani is that she is Pakistani. And as we know, Pakistan has caused the Pakistani community in the UK, in my opinion, have caused...
This segment of the interview has been censored. I'd like to show you the full thing, but YouTube is very sensitive to its speech codes when it's white people doing the speaking. So please subscribe to jollyheretic.com to watch or listen to the uncensored version.
And while it may not be Nus Ghani herself that has caused issue, it's you know, when you're doing public policy, you have sort of countries that you would red list. You cannot pick and choose among everyone. And so I just thought it was important for the public to know that this is a Pakistani lady born in Pakistan, ethnically Pakistani, and is in the UK House of Commons in that important role.
But you had a previous run-in with a controversial tweet in the summer, didn't you? Tell us a bit about that.
Yes. So again, I think that the reason why my tweets might be controversial is because I state the truth quite bluntly. The one in the summer was that, you know, there are people working in Marks and Spencer's at Heathrow Airport speaking in Hindi. And, you know, I travel in and out of the country all the time. And, you know, a few weeks before that, I was at Heathrow. And by the train station at Heathrow, all the staff were speaking among themselves in their own language. And so it's sort of like, you know, you're entering your own country, yet it's unrecognisable. The staff are completely unrecognisable, the language. And it's just another symptom of the decay of our country.
And what happened in response to that tweet?
So in response to that tweet, it had 5 million views, lots of comments, basically calling me a racist for pointing out the fact that, you know, they shouldn't be speaking Hindi while working in a public-facing role. And I was sort of brought up in lots of Indian newspapers, and that's as far as it went.
But then you also said to Jeremy Kyle on the on Talk TV that you had concerns about the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, because she's Pakistani. She was born in the UK.
Yes, and the reason there are concerns is because we know that the number one nationality seeking asylum in the UK are Pakistanis. And there is not a war in Pakistan. And by volume, there were over 10,000 applications, I believe, in 1 year. And they were not coming across on small boat. They were arriving in the UK, typically through planes, and then putting in an application through a loophole in the system. So they were exploiting that. And of course, these are fake asylum claims. My concern with the fact that the Home Secretary of the UK is Pakistani is you typically have inherent bias towards your own people. And so the fact that she has not called that out to me is problematic. And I'll go on to explain why. Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, singled out three countries that should be banned. Visa implications, which were the Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, and Namibia. And I will wholly defend those three countries because in terms of scale of those coming into our country, it's not those three countries. They are not the ones pushing large numbers. I believe it could have been Angola or maybe also Namibia that in one quarter, I believe the first quarter of this year, perhaps there were only about four people from that country entering. Perhaps it was Angola or Namibia. And so it's sort of targeting the easy countries. They did the same with Vietnam. They tried to target the Vietnamese when we all know that they are not the problematic ones. Yes, they may bring some problems once they're here, but you know, the inherent bias of not going for Pakistan for me is an issue.
Right. So why do you think that this particular tweet, this particular remark, because there was no great response to what you said to Jeremy Kyle. Why do you think this particular remark has about Nuzghani standing there in her male clothes, presiding over the budget? Why has this hit such a nerve, do you think, with a lot of people, including Conservative MPs, BBC journalists, David Aronovich? There's so many people that are quite prominent that have tweeted to condemn this.
It's because I believe I'm threatening the very heart of the establishment. You know, this is someone who for them would be a success story of integration, someone who came here from a young age, has an English husband, only has one child, I believe, and has rose the ranks in a Conservative Party. And so for them, it's sort of me saying, well, in their eyes, this is somebody that's very well integrated. And the fact that I've called out that person, they completely condemn it. That's one part. And the second part is that, you know, me being a young lady with a good educational background, they expect me to swallow up their narrative of how the United Kingdom should be. And I'm defying that. And not only do I defy it, but I double down. I haven't backed out and apologized. And I think that's hit a few nerves because of the huge amount of support. You know, we've also had Tommy Robinson, Lawrence Fox, Ben Habib, Ant Middleton, quite a lot of other big names coming out in support of me. And the establishment are afraid of that because I'm pretty sure the majority of the country are behind me on this. And they hate anything that threatens their establishment.
So you think it's relevant, what, because women are more risk-averse in general, young people are more left-wing in general, educated people are more left-wing in general, so it's symbolic of a change that's happening, and that's why it's frightened them so much?
Yes, exactly. That's why it's frightened them so much. They wouldn't expect this comment from me, perhaps. But I think the fact that I'm doubling down and there's so much more evidence we have to push this case, and we will continue to push this case.
And their response to you has been to try and cancel. You've had two newspaper articles. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so they're obviously totally ludicrous because rather than giving a counter argument, and Carl Benjamin, another big figure, of course, came out in support of me and said, rather than screech racist at Lucy, why don't you try and give the counter-argument? But obviously they cannot give a counter-argument because how could you justify explaining why there should be a Pakistani person in the UK House of Commons? I don't think that's much of an argument. And so instead of arguing against me, they have written articles about me using the word racist, racism, all these slurs, to try and shut me down. And again, the Guardian article was totally biased. They just cherry-picked the responses that said I was a racist and all this rubbish and put that into the article. And they completely ignored all the positive comments. So rather than give a nuanced article, which is, this is why some people support Lucy, this is why some don't, they just hammered me because they're trying to shut me down. They're trying to ruin my reputation, that it's not going to work. You know, this is not 2020 or 2018 anymore. People can see.
Well, that was interesting. There was an Oxfordshire Conservative councillor who was quoted in the Guardian article who said, "I am out doing canvassing for the local elections, and people are saying things that they wouldn't have said only a few years ago," or words to that effect.
Yeah, because you know, people are awake. You know, everyone has a pair of eyes. It's not hard to see the damage that has been done to our country. And I could quite frankly say to this Conservative councillor, well, your attitude of calling me a racist just shows why the Tories are extinct. They are dinosaurs. They are so out of touch and tone deaf that they cannot understand the sentiment in the country. And I understand the sentiment very well in this country. They don't. And that's why they are on track for 14 seats at the next general election.
And then there was an article basically summarising it in the Guardian article in the Daily Mail, but adding a few things like we reached out to Nusgani for comment. But they didn't reach out to you.
No, so neither the Guardian nor the Mail reached out to me for comment. And I have been advised that they were not supposed to, you know, it's essentially a breach. They should have reached out to me for comment. So I will be taking, you know, some sort of complaints their way because this is totally unacceptable.
Right. And the border issue, though, the idea constitutionally, why do you think it is such a problem? Andrew Bonar Law was prime minister in the early 20s. He was born in Canada. We would have had many examples of British MPs in Victorian times or whatever that were born in India, I'm sure. Why is it a problem constitutionally that Nusgani is born in Pakistan, she comes here, she's naturalised, she's integrated, she's a poster child almost for integration. So why is that an issue?
Well, there's a couple of responses there. The first one about the poster child, she may be the poster child, but when you peel back that poster, you can see what the Pakistani community...
This section has been censored. Subscribe to jollyheretic.com to hear the uncensored version.
So behind that poster, the poster child, when you pull that away and you look at the damage that's been happening in our country, I don't think people are falling for it. And yes, of course, someone, you know, British can be born abroad, but when they have ancestral ties to the homeland, they are still British. And I will give the example of, say if I or somebody similar to me were pregnant and happened to be travelling on holiday and they had a premature baby in another country, that baby is still British. Or if you were working as a diplomat abroad and you give birth there, that child is still British. It doesn't become, say, Japanese or Nigerian or wherever you happen to be stationed. So it is also about the ancestral links to the country.
So is it a danger? Do you think it's a danger for security to have people who are prime minister or home secretary or whatever else it's been now, deputy speaker of the House of Commons, in positions of power? They have ties to another country.
I think it's tremendously dangerous. And I can give you a few examples. You know, the most obvious one I can think of is David Lammy, who has, you know, one minute he's British, the next he identifies as Caribbean. He advocates for reparations. And so, you know, it's sort of like, well, if you're British then and you advocate for reparations in the Caribbean, then you're saying, oh, the British did this to us. But so if he's British, then didn't he do that to his own people? So there's a catch 22 here. You know, he's calling for trillions in reparations, which I think is dangerous and it's against the British interests. You look at Rishi Sunak and Priti Patel in positions of power in the Conservative government from 2019 to 2024. During that time, there were 1 million Indians that were let into our country. And I'm sorry, but that's no coincidence. When you had a Home Secretary and a Prime Minister that are of Indian ethnicity and origin, 1 million Indians coming in that short amount of time. So there's another example for you. Again, another example, which I think is very dangerous, is this, Iqbal, independent MP, advocating for first cousin marriage. And again, he is another Pakistani MP. And I think that's very dangerous because we all know that first cousin marriage among the Pakistani community has led to serious birth defects, which again is a huge strain on the NHS.
Yeah, but those birth defects are... if you have cousin marriage under conditions of harsh Darwinian selection, then if you have the birth defects, you die. And if you don't have the birth defects, then you're just very, very, very purely and strongly evolved to the environment and evolved to fight off the pathogens in that particular environment. That's why they do it. So if they have... As long as they have cousin marriage and they let the sickly children die, it's presumably not a problem.
Well, I mean, the rather broad point is that first cousin marriage, to advocate for it in Parliament, is just so bizarre and so un-British that I don't see any place for that in our Parliament.
Well, Charles Darwin married his cousin.
A long time ago, yes. But I just feel that right now, I don't think many people would be supportive of that notion.
Okay, but so with regard to things, the idea of a person being a problem that they're foreign, or they're half foreign or anything like that. Would you say that, for example, if Nuzghani has children and by this guy David Wheeland, I believe his name is, and they're half British and half Pakistani, then again it should carry on. They shouldn't be permitted to be members of Parliament, to be speakers of the House, to be government ministers. It's a danger even with them.
Well. That's a bit more nuanced because they do have sort of ancestral links to the country through the father. So I do think that is a bit of a different case to being directly from another country. But, you know, as long as your allegiance is to the British side of you and not the Pakistan side, again, I'd always be aware of these inherent biases, as I call them. But I do believe that having a British parent gives you that ancestral tie to our country and therefore hopefully would advocate in favour for that country.
What if you're adopted from South America or somewhere like that, but you came to Britain when you were 6 weeks old and it's all you've ever known? Is there still the possibility that the gods of your far-off land will reawaken in your blood? And you might become treacherous, or should we accept you as British completely if you've been adopted?
Yeah, there is often some built-up anger. Take Bob Villain, for example. But in the case of someone adopted, I guess it depends how much sort of he or she has been taught about their home country, or whether that's just not been an issue that's been raised. I think it's very much what environment have you been raised in as well.
Okay, so broadly then, how would you define British?
Well, I believe that if anyone can become British, what it means to become British means nothing. So back in the day, before mass migration, British, I believe, was a strong identity. But it's now been so watered down and diluted that if anyone that has a piece of paper saying they're British believes they are British, well, they're not the same as you or I, so then they are still something else. That's why I now would say that I am English, because I cannot identify with, you know, if, give the example, last year alone, 24,000 Indians and 22,600 Pakistanis gained citizenship, which technically means they're British last year, but they're not as British as you and I.
So, all right. So, I mean, Shabana Mahmood declared at the Labour Party conference that she is English, and Keir Starmer declared that his enemies were those that disagreed because they were opponents of British renewal or some nonsense. So, how would you define English? What is it to be English?
I mean, it's an ethnicity, it's an ethnic group. So, yeah. It's through your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents. I mean, for me, I sort of see it as, you know, most people would have had some family in World War II and before that in this country, so predating that time.
Oh, right. Well, then, yeah, you talk about family. It raises an interesting comparison, actually. Like, where do you draw the borders of family? What is your family?
Well, I feel that obviously, well, your family are, of course, your parents, your grandparents, etc., etc. But a lot of people in the UK might have one grandparent or great grandparent from across Europe. It could be, you know, from Greece or from Germany or from Norway. But that doesn't make them any less English.
I say it does. Surely they are less English. They are genetically less English. I don't have any grandparents or great-grandparents or indeed any ancestors whatsoever that I know of at all. and I've traced my family tree back a long way, that are foreign.
So I would still say that they're English, but of course you can argue that they're less English than someone with that can trace all the way back, you know, however many generations. But I think the argument today is that if, you know, for me, the main risk is very simple, is that we are being demographically.
This section has been censored. Well, why do you think that you get some people like Piers Morgan? He said this on his interview with Tucker Carlson, that, oh, it's fine. It's not a problem. Not a problem being a We have lots of curry. It's great. But what do you think motivates people that say things like that, which in previous times would have them hanged, but now as a society, even a society under threat, we just oh yeah, whatever. Why do you think that's happened?
I think it's partly one issue is white guilt. So you know, a lot of people have this white guilt that they've been they've been taught that. You know, we were evil, colonization was evil, the empire was evil, and they want to try and step away from that and break it down. I think the other issue is a sort of a globalist idea that nations shouldn't exist, and therefore it doesn't matter because we're all human beings on planet Earth. So someone like Piers Morgan is probably taking the approach that, well, why would it matter? Because we're all people and we should step away from our identity because it has bad connotations with it.
But there's this schizophrenia with him, because on the one hand he regards himself as anti-woke. How brave, how edgy. But on the other hand, he completely condemns people like you and anyone that says the kind of things that you're saying, which is that the preservation of the English people is important and that the English people are a distinct genetic people. I wonder how that kind of schizophrenia can be maintained in one mind.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea, actually. But the idea that, you know, food justifies mass migration is just insane. You know, if you read Douglas Murray's book, The Strange Death of Europe, he sort of says how, you know, having 100 Indian takeaway restaurants versus 100,000 Indian takeaway restaurants doesn't increase your enjoyment of Indian takeaways by, you know, 1,000 times. So it's this idea that having more and more and more of it doesn't increase our enjoyment of it. It's just very much overburdening. And, you know, I walk around the country and in large parts of it, it's unrecognizable, not just in the big cities, but now it's happening across the towns and the villages. Part of that could be because of the asylum seekers are being placed in hotels and dispersed across the country. There are many reasons for it. And I think that, you know, it's totally unfair for us as British or, you know, English people to be subjected to mass migration. And the irony is, or the paradox is, that English people are very welcoming, tolerant and polite. But it is this tolerance and politeness that has got us into this mess, because if we were pushing back more, perhaps resisting it more and standing up and speaking out, maybe we would be in this mess.
Yeah, on a few occasions, I've almost got into physical fights in pubs in Finland because I'm English and I'm in a pub in Finland. Okay. And someone has objected to the presence of a non-Finn in that pub. So that has happened. Well, I have experienced that once in England, actually. I walked into a pub in Loughton in Essex with a friend of mine who's half Japanese. It's about 26 years ago. And the atmosphere just changed in an instant and we were stared at, and it was made quite clear that you need to get out now. And I said to my friend, we need to make a retreat out of this pub. But that's because of him. But that's the only time. But going back to what I was saying, that I'm trying to draw a comparison where we define the nature of Englishness and the comparison with where we define the nature of family. So you'll say, well, yeah, my mum's my family, my dad's my family, my granny and granddad are my family, my brothers and sisters are my family, whatever, my cousins, maybe are they my family? Yeah, maybe. But what about second cousins? Borderline? Not sure. What about third cousins? Have you even met any of those? So there are nebulous borders, and people will include in their family. You know, people will surely, you love your dog more than your cousin.
Yes.
And he's not even the same species.
True.
So if we're going to compare, if we're going to say the English are an ethnic family, then is there not room in that for, like, when I was a kid, I'm about 13 years older than you, and I remember being in a pub and hearing these two blokes say, oh, I reckon they ought to send them all back where they came from. The other goes, yeah, I agree. Well, except Frank. Oh, yeah, except Frank. Yeah, he's one of us, it's Frank. I don't know if you know who that refers to.
Frank Bruno.
Right. And the attitude was that even though he's black, he was born in this country, he's married a white girl, he's fought for our country, and thus we accept him. We don't accept most black people. Most black people can get out, but we accept him. And so, is there not a case then, if in the same way that you might accept as your family a dog, or an adopted child from Africa, or whatever? There's these nebulous borders, I think. And the question is, like, has someone like Nuzgani, who's been born here, has completely integrated. She's even gone so far, as you pointed out to me yesterday, from having a massive family with 60 brothers or something, to just having one child. She's even done that. So is there not a case for her being permitted into the fold?
Well, I think the concern I have is, you know, she has five brothers and one sister. So six siblings plus her is seven. Then if you look at Sadiq Khan, he was one of eight. They were seven boys and one girl. And so the issue I have is it's not even necessarily individuals or on a personal basis. This is the thing. It's never a personal attack, but it's more the fact of a demographic problem. So if these families, say from Pakistan or other similar, with countries with similar cultures, come in with seven to eight children, I mean, that's the equivalent of, you know, two or three British families having two or three children. And that's that sort of this
section has been censored.
And so rather than saying, oh, I have a personal issue with you, it's never personal, because we can like individuals. It's just the fact that if we continue this attitude, the country will, I just don't see how we can go beyond repair, to be honest.
Would you say, I mean, if we were having this conversation in 1985 rather than 2025, the Home Secretary was not Shabda Mahmood, the Home Secretary was Leon Britton, and he was Jewish. And so obviously he's got an inherent tie to Israel. Would you say that that was a danger to national security?
I don't know much about that particular case, that Home Secretary, but I would say that anyone, they could be white Russian or Israeli or Chinese. So it's not even about race. It's about the fact that anyone with those ties has an inherent bias towards that country, even if they were, you know, German or French or etc. I do still think those inherent biases exist, and it's not their fault. You know, if I were myself in Spain, I would still be very much pro-British, even if I didn't realise.
So then the safest thing to do is to say to someone like Boris Johnson, look, Boris, mate, you've got a great grandfather that's Turkish. We're concerned you're going to be biased towards the Turks. You can't be a member of parliament, let alone prime minister.
Yes and no. So I think there was a lot of pushback on this about Boris Johnson being born in New York. My issue is, as I say, it's not that he was born in New York, because anyway, that's the US is a very culturally compatible country to the UK. So even if you were raised there, you would have your environment wouldn't be so distant. And the religion and the other sort of factors would remain constant, the same. So I think, you know, saying that Boris has a great grandfather who is Turkish, I do believe that there needs to be some differences between your parent and then your great grandparent. I do think that's been three generations. And so I think there is a case to be made that after three generations of one Turkish great-grandparent, perhaps that doesn't impact Boris as much.
But it's an interesting point, though, isn't it? That if you think about, you talk about the traditional English constitution, you mentioned this earlier to me, I can't remember that it was off camera, the traditional English constitution, and that this subvert it, this idea as well, in the jury trials that they're playing with at the moment. You're meant to be tried by your peers, tried by your equals. Well, if they're foreigners, are they your equals? Are they your peers? But it assumed that the people were English. But it assumed that you were trying you. But it assumed more than that. In the original English kind of constitution, and the people that voted were 40 shilling freeholders. The idea that you voted because you had a sufficient amount of resources that you wouldn't be open to revolution and nonsense and silly ideas, and you voted because the government were taking money from you in tax. And so the assumption was that you have the right to a say in how that money is spent, and therefore the right to vote for the representatives that will spend that money. Now, wouldn't it follow from that that at the moment, I live in this country, in Finland, and I pay tax, and I do not have the right to vote. I have taxation with no representation. And then you get people in this country that live off what we call keloraha, who are unemployed. And they have representation without taxation, just because they're Finns. And the clarion call of the American Revolution was no taxation without representation. So if we're going to be traditional about this, shouldn't we go further than saying that, oh, if you're not British, you can't be in Parliament or whatever? You shouldn't be able to vote. Shouldn't you be contributing to the economy in order to be able to say, I am contributing to the economy, I should have a say in how my money is spent.
Yeah, I've advocated for this before in previous, tweets that, essentially the government's budget is made up of taxpayers' money. And therefore, if you wish to decide how it is spent, you should contribute to that pot. There are, if you do demographic breakdowns of who is paying tax and who isn't, you will see in this country, in the UK, that 42% of Muslims between the age of 16 to 64 do not work. And again, that argument could just be, oh, well, it's almost half of them because they are women. But that reinforces my point, number one, of misogyny. And number two, if 42% of that group are not working, why do they have the right to vote?
Yeah, I agree with you. But by extension, then, presumably we should ban from voting anybody who works for the state because they're not contributing any money. And in Victorian England, they were banned. I mean, Anthony Trollope could not vote because he worked for the post office.
Yeah, I mean, these are all ideas to think about. I know, when you work for the government, yes, your salary is coming from that pot. And then yet they still remove some money towards you. You're still paying tax on that salary, even though it is from the same pot, and you're just contributing back into it.
Yeah, true. So they could get rid of tax then for government workers, and just, I mean, you used to work with the government, didn't you?
Well, yes. And I used to also work for the United Nations, and with the United Nations, you do not pay tax.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So why make it an ethnic issue, as you have done? Why not just make it an issue of, do you contribute or not? And if you contribute, yeah. Right.
No, so, I completely agree with that. It's not even about ethnicity here. In this particular case, there are many, white British families that, as we call it, sit on the dole or don't work or that cheat the system. And I've seen it. So it's not exclusively those groups. It's also the white British people. And of course, if they're not voting, paying tax and working, they shouldn't get the right to vote.
But then this gets back to this family issue we were talking about earlier, though, doesn't it? That there's a kind of a feeling that they're lazy, or they're down on their luck, or they're criminal, or whatever. But there are people. They're the black sheep of our family, and so we have a responsibility to look after the lazy, on the dole people of Clacton and Jaywick, and these kinds of deprived places. Whereas these people are just who are not working, are not doing anything, and we have to pay to look after them, they're not part of our family. They're just people that have sort of turned up and squatted in our front garden.
Yeah, well, I'd like to make this point. If you look at the Frank Brunos, for example, you know, back in the second half of the 1900s, immigration, of course, it was an issue. And you can look at polling around that we've always, the British have always said that immigration was too high. But the difference was when there were smaller numbers, they were sort of less of a problem because they were able to be absorbed in small numbers. But what's happened since Tony Blair in 1997 is that they've come across in large numbers, swarms, even, as I said, you know, 1 million Indians in sort of 5 years. Or if you look at, I think it was 2022, 2023, there was gross migration of 1.3 million people entering the country. And so those numbers, they cannot just be absorbed. And that's why you see big enclaves or pockets of towns like Tower Hamlets or Bradford or Birmingham that are purely one group, be them Bangladeshis or Pakistanis, etc., or Indians by Hounslow, by Heathrow Airport. So the fact is, from 1997 onwards is where I would kind of draw that line. But those that arrived before 1997 are still problematic because, one, Pakistani grooming gangs arrived before Tony Blair, and two, you know, it all becomes part of the whole, it's all been blurred now into the same issue of pre or post 1997. I think people disagree that there's too much migration. So it was
very difficult. I'd love to just say, I said to you this when I was speaking to you the other day off camera. I remember clearly and vividly the May 97 election and the hysteria the country was in, and then very quickly they started, almost immediately, started clamping down on free speech, you know, laws where if it's motivated by X, then you get a longer sentence or whatever. I remember seeing that aged 16 doing my GCSEs. Jack Straw talking about that and thinking, my God, that's very un-English, isn't it? This isn't on. This is restricting free speech. Aren't we meant to be a free country? In the 1980s, when I asked my mum what was the difference between us and the Soviet Union, she told me that we have free speech and they don't. This isn't on. This isn't what's supposed to be happening. But you see, you know, I perfectly happily say, 2nd of May 97, otherwise you are going home, whether you're born here or not. But then on the other hand, well, what do you say to somebody who's born in the late 90s and their parents are Latvian or something and they came here in the early noughties as a child and they've completely integrated and they speak fluent English and English is almost their first language and they have no interest in Latvia, they have no interest in anything like that, and they just want to be English like everybody else. What, and they have English friends, and that you can't really do that, and it would cause, it's bad politic. And it would cause so much social strife and so much pain.
Well, this is why we need a red list of countries. I don't think the Latvians are a problem in this country. And again, this is why it's not about race, because I would argue that Albanians are very problematic here. If you look at the data in terms of, you know, sexual assaults, I think, but also just crime, in general, the Albanians have a lot to answer for. And so that's why it's not about race. It's about the country and what are those people from that country doing in the UK? Are they problematic? Are they criminals? You know, a lot of the time we are collecting the data on this, different groups. You know, Restore Britain is doing very good work to try and get nationality breakdown. So as I say, it's not about race, because I would equally put a red list ban on Albanians.
Certainly Northern Albanians. Have you been to Albania? Have you been to Albania, Lucy?
No.
Southern Albania is really nice. Southern Albania is where Byron went. Greek ruins, not monetized yet. They're just lying there. You walk around. It's cheap food. €5 for a lamb's head and chips with Greek salad. Southern Albania is great. If I was from there, I'd never leave. But Northern Albania, as I understand it, is awful. And that's where they're from. But yes, but then what can we do in terms of making... I mean, Kazakhstan has gone from being minority Kazakhstani to majority Kazakhstani over the last sort of 40 years. So since the end of the Soviet Union. So it's 35 years, whatever it is. So it shows you that it can be done. It can be done. They went at their worst point. They were a minority in their own country. Now Kazakhstan is about 75% Kazakh. And all the Russians have left over a long period. Now, that kind of thing, though, is not really possible in a democracy, I suppose, though, is it? Going back to what we're saying about the constitution, you're going to constantly have changes of government. You're going to get a conservative government or a reformer government that tries to persuade foreigners to leave, and then a Labour government that just changes it back. Well, what can we do, do you think, to make Britain British again?
I mean, there's lots of things we can do. If we look at Donald Trump at the moment, he has implemented this red list, this ban of, you know, third world countries that he says should no longer come to the United States of America. So he's turning off the tap of those entering. But then, of course, he'll have to do something with those already in the country. So I believe one step is saying, look, you know, you can't say every single Pakistani is a bad person, but you can say that on the whole, they have been problematic to the United Kingdom. And so it's about being brave, putting it together a red list, Albania, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Afghanistan. I'm sorry, you know, Afghans are 22 times more likely to commit sexual offences than a British national. And it's about, so I would say, how do we make the country Britain again? You have to denaturalise a lot of these people, remove their citizenships, and you make agreements with their home country. If the home country refuses to take them, then you do all sorts of other policy measures, such as you withdraw foreign aid from that country, you pull away from bilateral trading relations. And if you can just sort of say, well, if you're not going to take them, we're also not going to take them. And I understand that someone technically cannot be stateless, but why should that be our problem? I think a lot of people, especially the foreign criminals or criminals that do have a British citizenship, they need to go. They shouldn't be in our prisons.
Well, one thing you could say is, if you don't take them, we will just invade your country and drop them in parachutes over your country. What are you going to do?
So yeah, I mean, there's lots of things.
There's a lot of things that people say are unthinkable. It's unthinkable. I mean, the idea of foreign aid, right? We give foreign aid to Kenya. We were ruling Kenya, and it was an organised country where the trains worked, and then the Mau Mau decided to chuck us out in doing all kinds of horrible things like massacring English families and stuff like that. So we left because they wanted us to leave. And now they ask for foreign aid. Doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. And so foreign aid is an interesting one. I mean, we've been giving foreign aid since the 1960s, in the sort of post-independence era. But my argument would be, well, it's been about 65 years that we've been giving these countries foreign aid, and yet it hasn't worked because they are still poor countries. And you know, I've lived and worked in a lot of developing countries, from Uganda. I've worked in Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana, Democratic Republic of Congo.
Why would you flagellate yourself in such a way?
Well, it's actually words to my understanding of how severe the situation is, actually. So I'm actually grateful to have worked in those countries, and the reason why, you know, seeing it firsthand, the reason why foreign aid does not work is because you have a capture of the elites, of the governments who will take that money into their pockets. You often see government ministers sending their children to boarding school in England. Yet the education system of their own country is in a dire state. Foreign aid, essentially, it's well-intentioned, but the issue is the host countries cannot absorb it, because you cannot throw money at an issue and expect it to fix a country. And so foreign aid is not working. I do believe that instead of, you know, millions of people continuing to come to England as a as an answer, that's not the answer. They need to fix their own countries, but with their own...
Also, it strikes me that if your country is falling apart into war such that it creates refugees, then that is a reflection of the... This section has been censored. That have caused their country to be chaos.
Yes,
and thus they will bring those chaos-inducing qualities to the UK, which is insane.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's again, I don't like to point my finger to the individual refugee because in their mind, they're trying to get to the UK for their own personal reasons, be it as an economic migrant or, you know, to come and cause havoc and chaos. But I blame our government. I think they are wholly responsible for all of this, because why is it even possible for them to be here in the first place? As you said, we know that
this section has been censored.
We have enough data on it. We know the rapes and sexual offences, just like the Pakistanis. So the question is, why do they, as a group, the people from these countries continue to come, and why does our government continue to allow it?
Well, it's probably elevated. It's probably that those kinds of people, that are the refugees, would not they're probably going to be reasonably... This section has been censored. So they probably wouldn't commit crimes like that in their own country. But they're in a country that has lax laws, and in which they feel like they're unimportant and they're useless and they're no good and they're at the bottom of the pile, and thus they feel resentment against the hand that feeds them, and thus they want to express their dominance by raping the children of the aggressor. I think that's how they feel.
Yeah, there's definitely a power dynamic to this. It's sort of, you know, their way to say, you know, we've been oppressed for all these years and we're going to come to England, the powerful country. It's like there are definitely power dynamics here at play. And if you read some of the transcripts from the rape gangs in the courts, they have admitted that that is why, you know, the Pakistani rapists were targeting white girls. It's often a way to reclaim that power. But we know all of these things, and that's what's frustrating, is that we have all the evidence. So why are they still here causing havoc and mayhem?
Well, indeed. I found one fine thing, so speaking of oppression and power. So you've been through this semi-cancellation, I think. And what the left would have us think is you're just an evil racist bitch with no feelings, that's just full of hate. I mean, tell people who've not been through it, how does it actually feel to have to be the centre of a negative newspaper storm like this?
If anything, it's more shocking. It's just more shocking than anything, because I don't think I did anything even racist or remotely wrong. I think I was stating something quite simple. I feel like I was very targeted, you know. I know people that have done way worse, you know, comments more outrageous than what I've done, but I think they targeted me. It could be because I'm an educated young lady, they're threatened. But I think in terms of the emotions, it's sort of, you know, you just sort of wonder, you know, who has seen this newspaper? How far does it go? But I'm a very strong person, so I wouldn't look at that and shut down, which is what they're trying to make me do. I think in politics, you need to have a very strong backbone. And if you believe something, you have to stand by it, because I know that I'm absolutely correct, which is why I'm able to continue going.
Why do you do it, though? I mean, most women, average women, normal women, wouldn't want to A, non-conform, and B, are highly socially anxious and would be absolutely mortified at this, but you don't seem to be.
Because I think that that's what's got us into this mess in the first place. Perhaps we need someone like myself to come out and put the argument. I think I can convince a lot of more, you know, other women, perhaps get more people on side, have that approach. I've always been someone that's outspoken, as I stand up for what I believe in. Yes, it is quite, you know, what's the word? It's quite daunting. Yes. It's quite daunting to put yourself out there like I'm doing. But for me, it's just a natural calling in life. And I just don't see, it's just so obvious to me that this is also wrong, that you have to stand up and do something. Like, I'm not essentially, put it this way, if I have children one day in this country, I don't want them to go to school with all these people from cultures that I they're just incompatible cultures. And the fact that Mohammed is the number one baby boy name in the country is terrifying. And yes, I understand that it's sort of a modal number, and that if you added up all the Jacks and the Peters and the Charlies together, that would probably outnumber Mohammed. But again, it's the fact that that's just one indicator of our society.
The Jacks and the Charlies are upsetting, though, because that involves people using a nickname as an official Christian name, which makes me very angry.
Okay, John. Let's say the John.
It's not that. It's never that. It's never that. It's chavs calling their kids Charlie, whether a girl or a boy, or Jack. But anyway, that's a separate issue. I'll talk about that with someone else another time. I would like to thank Lucy for coming on. And Lucy, if people would like to support you or find you online or whatever, where can they do so?
I would say my my Twitter X is the most useful point of contacts. Contact my messages are open. So that's Lucy Jane White 1, Lucy White on X.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. And best of luck and good luck, chaps. And keep up the fight. And see you all soon. And goodbye.
Are you ready for the future of the West?
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear the full thing, as well as help with my other projects, then please become a subscriber at jollyheretic.com.